Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. In 1962, the Supreme Court banned school prayer. It was an extremely controversial decision, but Dr. Sally Gordon of the University of Pennsylvania tells us that that decision paved the way for religious studies at state universities. You won't want to miss this conversation. Check it out. Well, that's kind of a nice lead-in to your address you gave yesterday. And because I kind of came in halfway through, so I didn't hear the whole thing. But when I came in, you were talking about a couple of court cases that led to the creation of religious studies.
Yes.
So can you walk us through that, especially because I didn't get to hear the whole thing.
Of course, and I love talking about this stuff. In 1962, the Supreme Court of the United States held that a very short and honestly vapid prayer that had been composed by a committee commissioned by the New York Board of Regents, the public school directors, to open the school day, a very short prayer that called upon God to protect our country, our teachers, and may we learn well. I mean, it really nothing that, that's not the exact language, but you get the sense. It was short, it was non-denominational, and it was challenged by, it was controversial. Many school districts refused to do it. Rochester, for example, said, we're way too diverse. We're not going to do that. But in a town in Long Island, a family challenged what was called the Regent's Prayer. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. And the Supreme Court said, governments have no business writing prayers. No, this cannot stand. And this was a very, very unpopular decision. 80% of Americans disagreed. Dwight Eisenhower disagreed. For the first time, Catholics disagreed. They had brought most of the anti-school prayers cases before that because the prayers were Protestant. In this one, it was a Jewish rabbi, a Catholic priest, and a Protestant minister sat down. It was prayer by committee. Can you imagine anything less meaningful? Anyway, it was a very unpopular decision. A year later, from right outside Philadelphia, a school district, Abington School District, was challenged by the family of a guy named Ellery Shemp. Very unusual last name. And they...
Three Stooges, right? Wasn't that his name, Shemp?
They were. Mo, Larry, Curly, and Shemp. Right. So, what was it? Whoop, 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 whoop. Anyway, the case got to the Supreme Court, and court watchers, as we're called, around the country predicted that the court might well walk back the decision because it had been so very unpopular. Instead, they doubled down. This case involved the recitation of the Lord's Prayer, not composed, right? Not composed by a state, and or Bible readings, you know, a few verses over the PA system at the beginning of the day. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. You cannot teach students how to be religious. You can't teach religion. Aye. And there was a 90-page concurrence by Justice William Brennan, a liberal Catholic, who said, you can't teach religion, but you can teach about religion. So much of our history, our art, our music, our culture is deeply informed by religion. Study that. Just don't make people pray, right? Because you'll never get universal agreement on prayer or on the Bible, right? Think of it, Dewey Reams versus King James. Would the Book of Mormon count, right? So you can imagine how complicated that gets. And Brennan's words were taken very seriously by a group called the National Association of Biblical Instructors, who taught college. And they, so this second case was decided in 1963, Abington School District against Shemp. In 1964, they changed their name to the American Academy of Religion. And to this day, religious studies scholars say, we teach about religion. They brag about how they never endorse or condemn any religion. They are students of religion. They don't teach you how to practice. They study you when you practice. And around the country, a new field was born, religious studies. The study, not the practice. And public universities began to create religious studies departments. The U, right up the hill from us here, the U put in a religious studies department, and it's very good.
Why doesn't BYU have one?
It's a different approach, right? So for religious schools, many of them don't have religious studies departments. They'd have theology departments.
Right.
Or philosophy of religion departments, or ministry or mission courses. So one of the things that happens is that public universities realize that the Supreme Court was talking to them. You can do this in state-run institutions. And so Indiana University, UC Santa Barbara, those are the two premier public school religious studies departments, but they're all over the country, and the field blossomed. And as I said, Jan Shipps, who taught the world how seriously they should take the Mormon tradition, her book used the tools of religious studies. She talked about prophecy. She talked about Exodus. She talked about sacred space, the kingdom in the tops of the mountains, and sacred time, traveling into the Old Testament, as the saints did as they voyaged westward. So I do think that we've learned a lot from religious studies. But our old friend William Brennan, right back there on the Supreme Court, what he, as a sensible Supreme Court justice, would have liked to see happen. I never got to ask him this. He died. He died in 1997, I think it was. But he stayed on the court a long time. I think he retired in 1990. But what he would have wanted, he was a man who loved tests. You know, is this put more of a burden on the person who's enduring it or on the government who has to forego providing health care to lots of other people or something like that? He loved to balance things and take different factors into consideration. And he loved expert testimony. So if he had a bunch of religion scholars who could educate courts about, I don't know, what counts as religion, right? Is this necessary to the practice of a given faith? What does this particular ritual mean, and why would it be important to observe it? Or is it something that could be, you know, parked in another time zone or done in a different way that didn't, I don't know, involve animal sacrifice or something harmful? And religious studies departments have been studiously avoiding answering just such questions. So one of the things that has been very difficult is trying to figure out what is religion and what isn't religion. And religious studies departments, full of really brilliant people who think deeply about religion, still have not settled on a definition of religion. So So the fact that the Supreme Court hasn't come up with a definition either maybe is understandable. But the other thing that religious studies scholars have done that is very productive is begin to poke holes in the divide between religion, religious and secular categories, arguing that virtually every form of secularism has religious roots and religious aspects. So it's when you show up at a court and you say, my religious belief says X, and the judge says, well, what does the religion scholar tell me about this? Is this really religious or secular? The religious studies scholar might say, that doesn't make sense. There's no such thing as, you know, a divide between those two. And so one of the things that I think has not worked in the ways that someone like Brennan might have hoped it would is that religious studies has not produced a smooth road for the Supreme Court. And many of them don't think that's their job. And they can be forgiven for thinking that way. But one of the things that has happened that is most harmful is that we have a very volatile, unpredictable law of religion, constitutional law of religion. The Supreme Court changes its mind. Its decisions are 5-4 and with bitter dissents. It's unpopular with much of the public, and its uncertainty means that people really invest in trying to get their cases up to the Supreme Court. And it's divisive, and it's become deeply political, and in that sense, is unhelpful. It draws people into bitterness, and anyone who's been involved in litigation knows it's not fun. It's really not fun, and honestly, religion on the pages of the Supreme Court reports appears flat. You just can't capture what it means to be dedicated to a faith when you have to flatten it so that it fits in a given constitutional category. It's not that the court's wrong. It's not that the faith is wrong. It's not that religious studies scholars are wrong, but we need them because we're not in a good way. Part of the polarization we see is deep, deep claims by some people that they've been written out of attention and power and the capacity to live their lives the way they want to. Others who are deeply afraid that their you know, precious capacity to exist the way they feel comfortable is under deep threat from those who want to take over and not allow for the, you know, the really rich diversity we have in the country. The Christian nation is a scary phrase to many people.
Well, yeah. It seems like there was another case involving Antonin Scalia that you talked about that kind of counteracted the Brennan opinion, is that right?
It did. It really cut it way back. But so that's a perfect illustration of how uncertain our case law is, because it's now getting ready for the guillotine. It's all, you know, justices have announced that they want to reverse it, and it looks like it may well go. In 1990, Antonin Scalia, who really was not a fan of the Free Exercise Clause, although he was a deeply religious man, he held that two Native Americans who had engaged in peyote rituals in Oregon and been fired from their jobs for doing so did not have a right to collect unemployment insurance. And that the first case that really protected religious liberty in a profound way was called Sherbert against Verner, and that was decided in 1963, just like Abington School District. William Brennan wrote the majority opinion in Sherbert against Verner and said that a woman who refused to work on a Saturday, she was a Seventh-day Adventist, who was fired from her job for refusing to work on a Saturday, deserve to get unemployment insurance. So a case very similar to the one involving the peyote rituals and being fired, and all they wanted was unemployment insurance. And what Scalia said is, listen, if there's a neutral and generally applicable law and it's been applied to you, you're out of luck. Sorry. You need another right. You know, you need another right. It could be speech. It could be, and so many, many scholars and lawyers and began drastically retrenching. It was a very unpopular opinion. And Congress was so ticked off at this that Scalia had virtually undone the Free Exercise Clause that they passed a law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1993, trying to reverse Scalia's opinion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it went back. There was a case involving a church in Texas that went back up to the Supreme Court. And in 1997, the Supreme Court held that, as applied to the federal government, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is unconstitutional. So it took a while, but about 5 years later, Congress passed a new law called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, that is to protect people confined in insane asylums, prisons, and other, you know, institutional settings, as well as land use. So one of the things you see, for example, in many suburbs or in urban renewal in city centers is they'll prohibit churches from or synagogues from locating there, in part because they don't pay taxes, and in part because they don't produce reliable traffic, right? They're episodic. And so there's good sort of city planning reasons not to allow that. But it's pernicious. It's really pernicious.
Because a city planner could say, I don't like the Mormons, we're not going to let you build a church here, or the Jehovah's Witnesses, or the Scientologists.
They wouldn't really say it that way.
I know, but
they'd say things like, soup kitchens are not a good idea for a flourishing downtown area where we want, you know, we don't want people sleeping under quilts that you have to step over to get to the restaurant. Right? That's how they'd put it, and I think that's how they'd mean it. It's very rare to see anyone sort of act that way. The case I'm thinking of that did feature something like that is a case called Church of Lukumi Babaluai versus Hialeah, and it's connected to the Mariel boat lift, which brought over a lot of practitioners of Santeria, which involves animal sacrifice. And Santeria practitioners had kept quiet for a long time, but they announced in the early 1990s that they were planning to build a church in the city of Hialeah. And this was a substantially Cuban versus Cuban battle. So the Orthodox Catholics brought in a priest to tell the city council about how bad this is. And the city council said things like, oh, we don't want those voodoo nuts, you know, practicing here. And so it was all over the place. And you see that sometimes in that kind of internal debate. You see it sometimes with eruvs. Do you know what those are? So for Orthodox Jews to carry on the Sabbath, they have to be within a certain sacred space. And generally, a very thin wire will get the job done, often strung on poles, utility poles or other poles or light poles. You'll see, for example, towns resisting an eruv because they point to other towns where an Erev went up and the Orthodox took over and everybody else moved out. So, and that's often an internecine fight among Reform and Conservative Jews and Orthodox Jews. So you can see that kind of, you know, targeting of a specific religion in that case. That kind, but really it's more about, you know, do we want soup kitchens or outdoor feeding of the poor in a downtown area when we're really trying to bring in, Starbucks, right? Or fancy restaurants and so on.
Okay. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Sally Gordon. In our next conversation, we're going to talk about another Supreme Court decision by Antonin Scalia that many legal scholars think will probably be overturned in our next court.
They do, and justices have said so themselves. Okay. Amy Coney Barrett, for example, said, we got to be careful, you know. If we reverse this, we have to figure out what's coming next. Because in the past 32 years, a lot has happened, including those two federal statutes. Which is, you know, really, that's a lot.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please subscribe to patreon.com/gospeltangents for just $5 a month. Patreon is spelled patreon.com/gospeltangents. If you'd like to watch the entire video, you can subscribe at YouTube, Patreon, or on my website at gospeltangents.com and click the yellow subscribe button for just $8 a month. PDF transcripts are just $10 a month, and you can get those on patreon.com/gospeltangents or on my website. I'll send those to you as soon as I've finished completing it. If you'd like to get a paperback and PDF, just subscribe for $20 a month at either Patreon or on my website. Individual paperbacks are available at amazon.com. Just do a search for Gospel Tangents interview, and you can find all of our past interviews there. Show your Gospel Tangents pride by purchasing a t-shirt on our website at gospeltangents.com/shop. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. You can get our latest updates by friending me at Facebook, or you can also follow our page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Become an insider and you can see the newest videos. Follow us on Twitter at gospeltangents. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some of our great videos. Thanks again.